leading apartment houses in the area. Moe's concept of middle-income rents, moreover, proved to be higher than Aetna's, so much higher that the people of East Tremont, who had proposed the project, realized that they were not going to be able to afford to live in it. One resident vividly recalls the Aetna meeting at which the Moe's proposed scale of rents was announced. A groan of despair went up from the room. Aetna tried Mitchell Lama, over which, by 1959, Moe's had little control. After weeks of effort, Janowitz, taking time away from his store, personally canvassed every vacant site of any size in the neighborhood. They came up with one that seemed perfect, a vacant tract next to the Bronx River, large enough for a 200-unit development. Officials of the Housing Redevelopment Board told them the tract was already owned by the city, so that there would be no problems with acquisition. In innumerable meetings with city departments, they plowed their way through masses of red tape. They found a developer who would build the project at a cost that would keep rents down to the level they wanted, and the developer's plans were approved by the Housing Redevelopment Board. And then it turned out that the board's original description of the ownership of the tract was not complete. The city did indeed own it, but only in the technical sense that it owned all land under the control of the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority. Moe's had acquired the tract some years before for another of his highways, the proposed Sheridan Expressway. "We found out who had title, and we were in despair when we heard it was Moe's," Mrs. D. says. Mrs. D. learned that only part of the land was needed for the expressway, and that if its route was shifted from the center of the tract to the side, plenty would be available for the housing project. Even if it wasn't moved, there would be enough land available for a smaller but still feasible project. "I asked Triborough for an appointment," Mrs. D. says. "They said it would take time and they would be in touch with us." They weren't. When she pressed for an answer about moving the expressway, they just said, "Impossible." "Then how about the rest of the tract, the part not needed for the expressway?" she asked. "I mean, this was something we could have gone ahead and done ourselves. Everything was ready. Triborough said that the Park Department had jurisdiction over anything left over. So I spoke to Park Department Executive Officer John Mulcahy. He said it would be okay if Triborough would say okay. Triborough said the Park Department had to decide. This went on for about a year." What happened at the end of the year, basically, was that the community gave up the fight. "You know, there wasn't one hell of a lot of fight left in it anymore," Ed Korn says. "They had taken our best housing. Our best people were gone. And Moe's had taken the heart out of those who were left. The manner, the style in which he operated affected them. The way he changed Bronx Park South. It was the same way he had operated with the expressway. Waking up Monday morning and finding out that he had announced something and there was nothing you could do about it. It wasn't just that this, the 159 structures torn down for the Cross Bronx Expressway, was very good housing stock, and that it was just torn down. It was the manner in which this was done. The manner had a major impact on how the community reacted to change thereafter. He left them with feelings of being isolated, left alone, that no one cared, no one listened to them. When they tried to protest, they were powerless. No one seemed to be interested in their problem. This does generate a feeling of helplessness, of resentment. We're abandoned. The manner, the implementation of the highway, affected the area as much as the highway. They had had their licks on the expressway. They had had their big community thing, and they had found out you couldn't do anything against him. There was a feeling of letdown, of discouragement, that nobody cared about them. Certainly he didn't care, and nobody else in the city interfered with him. The city just wouldn't listen. Downtown wasn't interested. People threw up their hands. What was the use? Mrs. D. and her associates had been begging the young couples who wanted to stay in the community to hold on for another year or two, until the new housing was available. "We got them to stay on for a while," she says, "but after a while we just couldn't keep telling them to wait, or if we told them that it wouldn't be long now, they didn't believe it. To tell you the truth, we didn't believe it either. With each month that passed, of course, the young couples could see the blight creeping closer to them. They began to move out faster and faster, and into the apartments they vacated moved the tenants East Tremont feared. Some of the older people in the area began to leave. As they left, the chief reason for staying in the neighborhood left with them. "To me, East Tremont was friends," Seal Sherman says. "When there was a Jewish holiday, you met your neighbors on the street, walking. Well, one Rosh Hashanah, I walked down from my house down Clinton Avenue to Southern Boulevard, crossed over, and walked back, and didn't meet one person I could say hello to. What was the sense of staying?" Thanks to the middle-income housing programs of the mid-1960s, there were now at least apartments, rentals, and low-priced cooperatives in decent areas that couples such as the Shermans could afford to rent or buy. Says Seal Sherman, "We left too." The 1 mile of the Cross Bronx Expressway through East Tremont was completed in 1960. By 1965, the community's very good, solid housing stock, the apartment buildings that had been so precious to the people who had lived in them, were ravaged hulks. Windows, glassless except for the jagged edges around their frames, stared out on the street like sightless eyes. The entrances to those buildings were carpeted with shards of glass from what had been the doors to their lobbies. In those lobbies, what remained of the walls was covered with obscenities, and not much remained. Plaster from the walls lay in heaps and corners. The bare wood which had been exposed was shattered and broken. The pipes which had been behind the wood were gone, ripped out, melted down, and sold for the few dollars that would buy the next fix. Elevators no longer worked. Staircases were broken and shattered. Banisters had been ripped from their sockets, for scrap and a fix if they were iron, for malice, an expression of hatred and revenge on an uncaring world, if they were wood. Raw garbage spilled out of broken bags across the floor. The stench of stale urine and vomit filled the nostrils. One tried to look down only enough to avoid stepping on the piles of feces, whether mercifully dried or reeking fresh, animal and human. There was no heat in those buildings. If they were homes, they were homes as the cave of the savage was a home. And yet they were homes, homes for tens of thousands of people. They were homes for welfare tenants and for the poorest of the working poor, for families that drift from one apartment to another without seemingly ever paying a month's rent in full, urban gypsies, for mothers who say desperately to the stranger, when they can be induced to talk to the stranger, "I got to get my kids out of here," and for the children who come to the door long after the knock is heard and peer around and ask the stranger, with fear in eyes and voice, "Are you the man from the welfare?" After 7 o'clock, the residential streets of East Tremont are deserted, roamed by narcotics addicts in gangs like packs of wolves. Even on East Tremont Avenue, by 9 o'clock, most of the stores are closed, the lights out, huddled behind steel gates and iron bars. The streets of East Tremont are carpeted so thickly with pieces of shattered glass that they shine in the sun. Garbage, soaked mattresses, bits of broken furniture, and everywhere small pieces of jagged steel fill the gutters. The sidewalks are full of holes. The streets, particularly the streets overlooking the expressway, for the expressway has made them dead-end, reducing traffic on them to a minimum, with the hulks of stripped automobiles. Once, East Tremont, while the expressway was being built, had had the look of blitzkrieged London. Now it looked as London might have looked if, after the bombs, troops had fought their way through it from house to house. It had the look of a jungle. Of the people who had lived in East Tremont, who had found in that neighborhood security, roots, friendship, a community that provided an anchor, friends and synagogue and why, a place where you knew the people and they knew you, where you could make a stand against the swirling, fearsome tides of the sea of life, only the very old, too poor to move, still lived, almost barricaded in their freezing apartments. As for the rest of the people who had lived there, they were gone. Chapter 39 The Highwayman. On July 3, 1945, with the end of the war obviously near, flashbulbs popped as a gray two-door sedan, the first civilian passenger car to be produced in the United States since February 1942, was driven off the assembly line at the Ford Motor Company's River Rouge plant to signal the resumption of automobile production. Within the month, River Rouge and a dozen other giant assembly lines were debouching 25,000 cars per day onto the nation's highways. And on the very first weekend after VJ Day, gasoline rationing ended, and America took to the road, with editorial writers cheering the seemingly endless procession of automobiles as a welcome return to normalcy. It took just 2 weeks for the cheers to turn to groans. Streets and highways, so empty for 44 months, filled up with astonishing speed, mounting day by day. By the end of those 2 weeks, traffic was back practically to its December 1941 levels. Nowhere did it mount faster than in New York, and New Yorkers who may have forgotten that in December 1941 traffic jams had ceased to be a joke had their memories harshly jogged. The city's consternation was echoed by its press, which detailed the jams in the type of page one scare headlines that for 44 months had been reserved for war bulletins. "Avenue traffic is tied up by cross-street congestion," read one Times headline. "North-south arteries jammed 3 times in 2 hours as lines of east-west vehicles extend across the intersections." By August 23rd, the Herald Tribune was demanding to know why the city had not, during the long breathing space afforded by the war, come up with congestion remedies. Moses' response, a letter 4 times longer than the editorial, sped to the Tribune by limousined secretary, accused the newspaper of ignoring and playing down what in other less busy and sophisticated communities would be hailed as great achievements. What has New York done about street congestion? Bless your little journalistic hearts. A hell of a lot. And why sit we idly by without further plans for the big jam, singing "Who Threw the Whiskey in the Well?" while up in the roaring 40s editors are cutting up tires into rubber heels? Tush, tush. The blueprints are oozing from our files and spilling over the floors. Every day sees visiting firemen in New York, not only from the hinterland of America, but from the four corners of the emancipated globe, examining our work and asking for copies of our plans. Why are they here if there is nothing to see? Let's see. We have built and are building wide parkways and expressways, bridges and tunnels, without crossings and lights, with service roads for local use and parking, belt and crosstown systems, which take through traffic off ordinary streets and enormously cut down congestion. Then we have great new parking spaces in parks, at beaches, and along parkways. We have eliminated railroad grade crossings, which blocked traffic for miles on Atlantic Avenue and Rockaway, and substituted boulevards for tracks. Trolley tracks are being ripped up all over town to promote the flow of traffic. Stick around, Mr. Editor, and continue to give us your support. Traffic will run pretty smoothly here within 3 years, the time needed to carry out our plans. Soon, Moses was documenting the extent of those plans. Blueprints were ready, he said, for widening the city's old boulevards, Horace Harding, Queens, Conduit, Northern, Eastern, and his old parkways, the Belt, the Gowanus, the Cross Island, the Laurelton, and for building close to 100 miles of new, broader roads, expressways, to carry not only automobiles, but trucks and buses. Soon, New York's newspapers began to be filled with names like Bruckner, Van Wyck, Major Deegan, Cross Bronx, Brooklyn Queens, Harlem River, New England, Richmond, Willowbrook, Clove Lakes. Also on the agenda, he disclosed, were 3 monumental crossings of Manhattan Island: Lower Manhattan, Mid-Manhattan, and Upper Manhattan elevated expressways. And that was just within the city. On Long Island, the old parkways, whose names were synonymous with his, The southern state, the northern state, the Wantagh, the ocean, were to be widened and extended, the northern state deep into Suffolk County, and new parkways, the Meadowbrook, the Captree, were to be built. In Westchester, the Cross County and Sprain Brook parkways were to be built, the Taconic, Bronx River, and Sawmill widened. The blueprints may indeed have been spilling over the floors. What Robert Moses was proposing was the widening or construction from scratch of no less than 200 miles of roads. And the agenda did not include merely roads. There were also the facilities to carry traffic under and over the waters that divided the city. While completing Ole Singstad's huge Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, he had begun preliminary planning for two huge bridges, a Throgs Neck span 2 miles east of the Bronx Whitestone, and a Narrows Crossing to Staten Island. During the 1920s, Robert Moses had announced a program, his statewide state park and parkway program, that had dwarfed any plan for the recreation of vast urban masses conceived anywhere in the world in recorded history. During the 1930s, Robert Moses had announced a program of New York City bridge and arterial highway construction and park reconstruction, which, taken as a whole, as the single coordinated system it was, dwarfed any public work or coordinated system of public works built in any modern city, and perhaps in any ancient city as well. The program Robert Moses was announcing now, during the 1940s, would, if completed, dwarf those earlier programs. And, he said, there was no reason why it shouldn't be completed. It was, he said, no mere visionary dream. Not only blueprints, but money, mostly state and federal money, reserved during the war years through his efforts in Albany and Washington, were largely in hand. The post-war highway era is here. But, strangely, the troops did not respond to this ringing trumpet call as they had to his trumpet calls of the past. Even before the war, of course, some urban planners had begun to see, largely because of the effects of Moses' creations, that building more traffic facilities would not in itself cure traffic congestion. These planners had said, the Regional Plan Association had been saying it since 1929, and, after the opening of Moses' creations during the 1930s, with increasing urgency, that the movement of people and goods in a great metropolitan region required a balanced transportation system, one in which the construction of mass rapid transit facilities kept pace with the construction of roads. During the last 2 or 3 years before the war, a few planners had even begun to understand that, without a balanced system, roads not only would not alleviate transportation congestion, but would aggravate it. Watching Moses open the Triborough Bridge to ease congestion on the Queensborough Bridge, open the Bronx Whitestone Bridge to ease congestion on the Triborough Bridge, and then watching traffic counts on all three bridges mount until all three were as congested as one had been before, planners could hardly avoid the conclusion that traffic generation was no longer a theory, but a proven fact. The more highways were built to alleviate congestion, the more automobiles would pour onto them and congest them, and thus force the building of more highways, which would generate more traffic and become congested in their turn in an inexorably widening spiral that contained the most awesome implications for the future of New York and of all urban areas. The only remedy that could check that vicious spiral was the coordination of new highways with new mass transit facilities. And not only was New York's coordinator not planning any such facilities himself, his monopolization of construction funds and his hold over the city's government were making it impossible for anyone else to plan them either. He was, in fact, destroying some of the old facilities, not only the trolley tracks, which he was boasting about ripping up all over town, but the Third Avenue elevated mass transit line, which he was moving to have torn down. Viewed in this light, tearing tracks up and elevateds down was not an achievement, but a disaster. And tearing them down was only one method of destroying mass transportation facilities. Moses, whether by design or out of ignorance of the effect of his policies, was employing other methods with equal effect. Highways competed with parallel mass transit lines, luring away their customers. Poor public investment into the improvement of highways while doing nothing to improve mass transit lines, and there could only be one outcome. Those lines would lose more and more passengers. Those losses would make it more and more difficult for their owners to sustain service and maintenance. Service and maintenance would decline. The decline would cost the lines more passengers. The loss in passengers would further accelerate the rate of decline. The rate of passenger loss would correspondingly accelerate, and the passengers lost would do their traveling instead by private car, further increasing highway congestion. No crystal ball was needed to foretell such a result. It had already been proven, most dramatically perhaps in New Jersey, where the Susquehanna Railroad had lost over two-thirds of its passengers in the 10 years following the opening of the George Washington Bridge, but also in New York, where the New York Central had been hit hard by the Triborough Bridge, and the Long Island Railroad had watched more passengers drift away each time a new Moses Parkway opened. No crystal ball was needed, therefore, to foretell the end result of Moses' immense new highway construction proposal, coupled as it was with lack of any provision whatsoever for mass transit. It could not possibly accomplish its aim, the alleviation of congestion. It could only make congestion, already intolerable, progressively worse. His program was self-defeating. It was doomed to failure before it began. It just didn't make sense. It made less sense still, these planners felt, because of certain implications peculiar to the Moses style of highway building. Roads opened new areas to development. Moses' pre-war parkways had caused a vast upsurge in population on Long Island before the war, both in Brooklyn and Queens, and in the suburban counties of Nassau and Suffolk. Subways opened areas to development too, but development in a different pattern. Because people arrived home from the subway on foot and didn't want to walk too far after they reached their stop, subway-inspired development was development close to subway stations, high-density, predominantly apartment house development. There were suburban-type, single-family home communities in New York City served by the subway. Sunset Park was one. But the single-family homes in these communities had been placed on small plots by developers who knew that to make these homes attractive to prospective purchasers, they would have to keep the radii of the communities and the required walking distance within them reasonable. People arriving home on parkways arrived home in automobiles. It was relatively easy for them to travel far longer distances from their stops, the parkway exits. Realizing this, developers were able to take advantage of people's growing desire for open space to build on larger plots of land, to spread out the communities in which people lived. Even in Queens and southern Brooklyn, communities created by the opening of Moses Cross Island and Belt Parkways were characterized by larger lot sizes and lower population densities than those created by the opening of subways. Development beyond the city line, freed from the inhibition against large lots inherent in the city's rigid gridiron block pattern, spread more loosely and widely still, and as the open spaces of Nassau began to fill up and developers looked for fresh stretches of land to subdivide, they found themselves looking and building new communities much farther away from the center of the city than would have been the case if the impetus to such development had not been roads, but railroads. Once, growth in the New York metropolitan region had been, to a great extent, upwards, people being piled on top of people in apartment houses. Now, the growth was outwards. Not only was the population of the region growing rapidly, 9 million in 1920, it was 11 million in 1930, and despite the breaking effects of the Depression, 12 million in 1940, but it was spreading away from the traditional center of the region even more rapidly. Had jobs followed the people out into the suburbs, the implications of this spread might not have been so serious. Given the advantages of open space, they might in fact have been desirable. And normally, because land was relatively so cheap on Long Island, businesses and industries would have followed the people out. But Moses' policies made it impossible for them to do so. Most roads foster commercial as well as residential development. But his parkways were barred to commercial traffic. his behind-the-scenes persuasion of Long Island politicians to zone residential almost all the adjacent land may have kept the parkways pristine and beautiful, but it also kept the land most desirable for commercial development on Long Island closed to such development. Industries and businesses which could have imported raw materials and shipped out finished products by rail instead of truck shied away from Long Island because the Long Island Railroad, whose lines should have formed the hub of industrial development, was a rickety Toonerville trolley line, and because without a rail connection to New Jersey, the rail lines which brought the goods and commerce of the nation into New Jersey could transport it to Long Island only by expensive lightering. So industry and business stayed back in New York City. In the decade after Moses opened the Southern State Parkway in Nassau County, 200,000 new residents, about 50,000 families, moved into the county, but only 12,000 new jobs were created in the county. This meant that about 38,000 family breadwinners, plus tens of thousands of others from the Parkway-opened areas of Brooklyn and Queens, had to come back into the city to win that bread. Hardly had the war ended when the surge to the suburbs resumed its pre-war pace, leaped beyond it, and soared to hitherto undreamed-of proportions, spilling beyond Nassau into rural Suffolk. Every projection made by planners showed that hundreds of thousands of families would be moving to Long Island within the next few years. The vast majority of the family breadwinners were going to have to travel into the center city every day to work. To the drivers who had already crammed to capacity and beyond capacity all Moses roads would be added tens of thousands of additional drivers. How could you possibly build enough roads to accommodate them? And what about city streets? Once these tens of thousands of additional cars reached the center city, how were they supposed to move around in it? Above the streets? The blighting effect of elevated structures had long since been documented. We did not tear down the elevated mass transit lines to have them replaced with a maze of overhead motor highways which would rob the city of light and air, said Manhattan Borough President Edgar J. Nathan, Jr., a reformer. Below the streets? The maze of underground subways and utility lines made underground construction prohibitively expensive. On the streets? The streets were already crammed with all the vehicles they could possibly hold. And where were these cars supposed to park? To Moses' highway trumpet call, Nathan quickly added a low-key but penetrating counterpoint. Mr. Moses explains everything beautifully, but not where the motorists are going to put their cars. Planners and reformers picked up the theme. Curbs in the city's central business district were already crammed bumper to bumper, and so were off-street private parking garages. Long Island, of course, was not going to be the only source of additional cars. What about the cars that would be attracted into the city by the new roads Moses wanted built in Westchester County, and by the new roads being built in New Jersey, roads leading to the Lincoln Tunnel, to which the Port Authority was planning to add a third tube, and the George Washington Bridge, to which it was planning to add a second deck? Moses' answer was municipal construction of off-street, multi-story parking garages. The answer caught the fancy of headline writers, but planners, costing them out, saw at a glance that no expenditure the city, or even a new public parking authority, could possibly afford could build enough garages to accommodate more than a small fraction of the load Moses was planning to dump on them. Planners and reformers were raising other questions about Moses' policies. The coordinators' proposed highways and garages were designed to help automobile-owning families. But in 1945, two out of three residents of New York City belonged to families that did not own automobiles. Many of these families did not own them because they could not afford to. The coordinators' subway fare increase proposals being advanced at that very moment in Albany would force poor New Yorkers to devote more, in many cases more than they could afford, of their slender resources to getting around the city. The coordinators' grabbing of the lion's share of public funds for highways and garages meant that public resources would be poured with a lavish hand into improving the transportation system used by people who could afford cars. Only a dribble of public resources would go into the transportation system used by people who could not, and who therefore rode subways and buses. While the city and state were providing car users with the most modern highways, they would be condemning subway users to continue to travel on an antiquated system utterly inadequate to the city's needs. While highways were being extended into suburban areas of the city in which highways were needed, and in fact into areas of the city in which highways were not needed, in which the need for highways would be created by the highways, subways would not be extended into areas of the city in which subways were needed. There were subway plans, too, just as there were highway plans. Some, such as the proposals for a Second Avenue subway for Manhattan's Far East Side and the Bronx, and the Hillside Avenue subway extension for northeastern Queens, were advanced enough so that construction could have been begun immediately if funds were provided. But the coordinator's monopolization of public funds made subway construction impossible. By building transportation facilities for the suburbs, he was ensuring that no transportation facilities would be built for the ghettos. Therefore, planners saw, in the transportation field, the portion of the public helped by the use of public resources would not be the portion of the public that needed help the most. For the well-to-do residents of the suburban areas of northeastern Queens, not having a subway nearby meant having to take a bus or drive a car to the end of the line in closer to Manhattan, or having to drive all the way into Manhattan and back every working day. This was a hardship. But for the impoverished residents of the southeastern Bronx, not having a subway nearby and not owning a car meant taking a bus to the subway, and that meant paying a double fare each way, twice a day, 5 days a week, and that meant paying money that many of these residents simply could not afford. And that meant that often these residents walked to the subway, walked a mile or more, in the morning and home in the evening, when they were tired. And it meant that on weekends, families that would have liked to take their children on trips, to a museum or a movie downtown or Coney Island or some other park, particularly to a park, since Moses had built few in lower-class neighborhoods, or to visit a friend who lived in another neighborhood, stayed home instead. The coordinator's policies were doing more than simply not helping these people. They were hurting them. They were even limiting their freedom to choose a place to live. His denial of funds for the extension of mass transit lines into outlying sections of the city and into the suburbs meant that the new homes and apartments there would be occupied only by car-owning families. Whether by design or not, the ultimate effect of Moses' transportation policies would be to help keep the city's poor trapped in their slums. They were, in effect, policies not only of transportation, but of ghettoization, policies with immense social implications. "We knew we had to do something to halt this trend," reformer Lee Denniston said in a letter to the editor, "and we were asking how best to do it." The answer to all the questions raised about Moses' transportation policies was, of course, mass transportation. The problems involved in moving tens of thousands of commuters into and out of the center city in a couple of peak hours every weekday, problems so unmanageable in terms of highway lanes whose peak capacity was 1,500 cars per hour, were reduced to manageable size by rapid transit lines, a single track of which could carry between 40,000 and 50,000 persons per hour, and could bring them into the city without their cars, so that they wouldn't require parking spaces. Mass transportation was, moreover, the only answer. New highways had a vital function to fulfill, the transportation of people and goods that, for whatever reason, had no choice but to use highways at a reasonable rate of speed. If you had a viable mass transit system in the region, fast, clean, reasonably inexpensive modern subways and suburban commuter railroads, you would attract to it a substantial share of the traffic that did have a choice, and by removing it from the highways, you would free the highways so that they would be able to fulfill this function. If residents of the region, particularly commuters, did not have a choice, if they were forced by the inefficiencies, inadequacies of service and high fares of mass transit to use highways whether they wanted to use them or not, the highways would never be able to fulfill their function. Build railroads at the same time that you were building roads, and solving the metropolitan transportation problem would be greatly simplified. pour all available funds into roads without building railroads, and that problem would never be solved. Public exposure to this point of view was limited. Editorials, such as the one in the Herald Tribune that so aroused Moses' ire, were rare, non-existent in the two newspapers most decisive in shaping public opinion in New York, the Times and Daily News. The news cheered Big Bob the Builder's greatest highway plan. Watching traffic pile up in the city, New York's press was screaming for action, and Moses' plan promised plenty of what it considered action. The public, conditioned by pre-war decades of acclaim for road building, accustomed to equating the value of a public work with its size, unaccustomed to critical analysis of public works programs, desperate for action, showed no greater understanding, no comprehension that there might be drawbacks to the biggest road building plan ever. Writing in PM in May 1946, Lewis Mumford tried to explain some of the social implications of building without planning. A large part of the money we are spending on highways right now is wasted because we don't know whether we want people where the highways are going, he said. But Mumford confessed to despair that the public would understand. Highways are an impressive, flashy thing to build. No one is against highways. One did not have to be a Mumford, however, to grasp the fact that Moses' policies might be self-defeating. All one had to do was think about those policies for a while. And, sitting in their cars day after day in ever-lengthening traffic jams, New Yorkers were finding themselves forced to indulge occasionally in that activity. While Moses' plans enjoyed public support through the 1940s, there were signs that it was not as unanimous after the war as it had been before. Denniston's letter was only one of many in which people were trying to articulate new, disturbing thoughts. Within 2 months after the war's end, editorial pages, not the editorial columns, but the letters to the editor columns, in a number which strongly suggests that on this issue the public was ahead of the press, began to contain suggestions like that published on October 22, 1945, in the Times. Why not bar all private cars from Manhattan? By 1946, such letters were common. The more informed sections of the public, businessmen exposed at their weekly Rotary or Kiwanis or Chamber of Commerce luncheons to guest speakers familiar with the problem, for example, were even better exposed to analyses of Moses' policies. It was no longer unusual to find in the back pages of the Times or Tribune articles like the one reporting that on January 23, 1947, Leslie Williams of the American Transit Association had, in an address to the New York City Safety Council, expressed the view that it would be a whole lot cheaper for a community to subsidize public transit than to spend enormous sums for downtown expressways with no assurance even then that these expressways will relieve congestion. Rebuffed by O'Dwyer, who summarily referred their inquiries and suggestions to Moses, and forced to admit to themselves that they could suggest no immediate method of financing new mass transit lines, these planners pleaded for the city to take at least one simple, inexpensive step that would make construction of new lines possible in the future. Building transit lines underground was wildly expensive. Building them at ground level was cheap, so far as construction costs were concerned. It was only when the ground was filled with people that the cost of acquiring it became financially and politically prohibitive. And, planners said, there existed at that very moment an opportunity for obtaining the right of way for train tracks quickly, cheaply, and with an absolute minimum of public hostility. The city was about to begin acquiring close to 100 miles of strips of land between 150 and 250 feet wide, the right of way for the coordinator's new highways. Some of these highways were to run through areas either empty or containing only single-family homes, in which land was relatively inexpensive. In 1945, 21% of the city was still undeveloped. Simply obtain another 50 feet of right-of-way, add it to the center malls of Moses' highways, and there would be room enough on those malls for a double-track surface mass transit line, a subway running at ground level. Build the six-lane highways just as you had been planning to do, they urged Moses, but make the center mall wide enough to accommodate those tracks. Then, when, sometime in the future, the city was ready to build the subway lines, there would be no problem in acquiring the right-of-way. It would be already available, just sitting there waiting for the tracks to be laid atop it. Seizing this opportunity would slash at a stroke the Gordian knot of difficulties in the way of providing mass transportation in New York. Residents of adjacent buildings naturally opposed the construction of noisy, dirty rapid transit lines, often in numbers sufficient to make construction a political impossibility. Build rapid transit lines in the middle of highways, and there wouldn't be any adjacent buildings. The nearest buildings would be cushioned from the train's impact by a good 100 feet of space, and in the case of expressways depressed in open cuts, by their location below ground level as well. Highways caused noise and dirt and objections too, of course, but the highways were going to be built anyway. Trains on their center malls would add to such inconveniences only minimally. As long as the city must be provided with new mass transportation facilities, and as long as these facilities could not be built underground, building them on highway center malls was surely not only the cheapest way to build them, but the easiest way to minimize political and aesthetic fallout. If there was any long-range prediction that could be made with any certainty about a city as volatile as New York, these planners felt, it was that such an opportunity would never come again. Expressways spawned intensive development, apartment houses, factories, office buildings, where there had been before only open fields or private homes. The city could afford to acquire open fields or private homes, even the long miles of fields and homes required for Moses highways. It would probably never be able to afford acquiring long miles of apartment houses, factories, and office buildings. And even if it were in some future decade to find the cash to do so, would it be able to find the will? Would not the protests of thousands of voters make the acquisition politically unfeasible? Acquisition of rapid transit right-of-way, so easy in conjunction with the current expressway program, would never be easy again. It might, in fact, be impossible. Fail to grasp the present opportunity, and the city might never be able to build sufficient mass transit to significantly improve transportation. There were no logical reasons not to grasp this opportunity. No federal approval was necessary. The cost of land acquisition was split by state and city. The state was leaving absolute discretion over the design of Robert Moses highways to Robert Moses. The city's share would be so small that even impoverished New York would be able to afford it. The suggestion was not even revolutionary. Plans were already underway for the placing of a mass transit route down the center mall of the proposed Congress Street Expressway in Chicago. The suggestion was so logical that it did not even require much imagination to grasp it. All that was required was common sense. F. for Francis Dodd McHugh asked Moses to grasp it in planning the Van Wyck Expressway. McHugh, a little bright-eyed Scotsman, had, as chief of the Office of Master Planning of the City Planning Commission, previously aroused Moses' hostility by objecting to his refusal to make provision for schools, libraries, and transportation facilities for the residents of his huge housing projects. Calling Mr. McHugh a smart aleck and his objections stupid, long-winded, contentious, and impractical, Moses told his boss, Edwin Ashley Salmon, "We had better get rid of staff work of this kind." But McHugh had declined to take this subtle hint. Assigned to draw up a pro forma master plan of New York City airports, he ventured beyond the assignment and asked himself how people were going to get to these airports, and came up with some rather striking figures. By the most conservative estimates, when the immense new airport under construction on the marshes at Idlewild Point in southeastern Queens was in full operation, 40,000 persons would be employed there, and 30,000 passengers would pass through it every day, most of them during morning and evening peak period rush hours. If traffic patterns conform to those at other major airports, during peak periods 10,000 persons would be trying to get to Idlewild every hour, some of them in multi-passenger buses, but enough of them in taxis and private automobiles so that they would be traveling in 3,220 separate vehicles. and heading for Idlewild at the same time would be hundreds of trucks carrying airmail, express, and freight. Most of these vehicles would undoubtedly be using the Van Wyck Expressway. Moses' stated purpose in proposing it was to provide a direct route to the airport from mid-Manhattan. But the Van Wyck Expressway was designed to carry, under optimum conditions, good weather, no accidents or other delays, 2,630 vehicles per hour. Even if the only traffic using the Van Wyck was Idlewild traffic, the expressway's capacity would not be sufficient to handle it. And Idlewild traffic was going to be only a fraction, a small fraction, of traffic using the Van Wyck. The new expressway would be the most direct route not only to the airport, but to all southeastern Queens and to the Southern State Parkway leading to fast-growing Long Island. During highway rush hours, which coincided with airport rush hours, the Van Wyck was going to be flooded with thousands of cars heading for these destinations. The new road Moses was building could not, even under optimum conditions, possibly come anywhere near fulfilling the purpose for which Moses was building it. And McHugh, who estimated all this traffic conservatively, could not help knowing that his conservatism was not realistic. The air age was just beginning. Air traffic was obviously going to boom to immense dimensions. If the Van Wyck Expressway could not come anywhere near handling Idlewild's traffic when that traffic was 10,000 persons per hour, what was going to happen when that traffic increased to 15,000 persons per hour, to 20,000? Moses' answer was that he was going to widen two other routes to southeastern Queens, the Belt Parkway and Conduit Boulevard. But Parkway and Boulevard were already jammed far beyond capacity. Widen the two roads and they would still be jammed, even without Idlewild traffic. Widening roads could not possibly solve the Idlewild access problem. You'd have to pave over most of southeastern Queens to do that. Building the Van Wyck Expressway was going to cost $30 million. The principal result of the expenditure of that staggering sum would be the condemnation of most of the drivers using the Van Wyck, of generation after generation of drivers using it, to the frustration of being trapped, some of them twice a day for every working day of their lives, in staggering traffic jams. Building the Van Wyck would raise other questions. Once the cars using the expressway got to the airport, how were they supposed to get around in it? An internal road network of enormous cost and size would be required, and even then, congestion inside Idlewild might be even worse than the congestion outside. Where were they supposed to park? Parking lots covering hundreds of acres, thousands of acres, expanses of concrete stretching endlessly over the marshland would be required. Since the marshland would have to be filled in before it could be paved, the construction of such lots would be enormously expensive. If the lots stretched for miles, parts of them would be miles from the airline terminals. How were the drivers and their luggage supposed to get to the terminals after they parked? Only by building the Van Wyck with rapid transit could all these questions be answered. Three lanes of this particular expressway, not engineered up to later design standards, could, under optimum conditions, carry each hour 2,630 vehicles, most of them bearing a single passenger. One lane of rapid transit could, under optimum conditions, carry 40,000 persons per hour. And with rapid transit, conditions would be optimum far more often than on a highway, whose capacity was reduced far more severely by rain or snow or fog, or by blockage by an accident or breakdown. Build the Van Wyck with rapid transit, and you would be ensuring that for generations, persons traveling to Idlewild would be able to get there with speed. An express trip from Pennsylvania Station in mid-Manhattan to the airport would take exactly 16 minutes, and comfort. And, since the long lines of cars would melt off the expressway, those drivers who still wanted to get to Idlewild by car would also be able to get there with speed. Building the Van Wyck with rapid transit would, moreover, be easy. The North-South Expressway was going to cross Queens Boulevard in Kew Gardens. A subway, the IND East-West line running out from mid-Manhattan 8 miles away, crossed that very intersection. When it reached the intersection, moreover, it slanted south, by coincidence, toward Idlewild, for about a mile before heading east again. During that mile, its tracks lay almost precisely beneath the right-of-way that Moses was even then acquiring for the Van Wyck. For a mile of its 4-mile length, therefore, the expressway would be running almost right on top of the subway. All that was needed to complete a rapid transit link between mid-Manhattan and Idlewild was to bring that subway up to the expressway's center mall and extend it for another 3 miles. 9 miles, 9 expensive miles, of rapid transit link between mid-Manhattan and Idlewild were already completed. All that was needed to complete the link were 3 miles, 3 inexpensive miles, more. Moreover, another subway, the IND's Fulton Avenue line, coming out from lower Manhattan through downtown Brooklyn, ran close to Idlewild's western edge. Build a branch of that line into the airport, a simple, inexpensive job, and travelers from lower Manhattan, including the Wall Street Business District, from which would come so large a proportion of the airport's users, would also be able to reach it by train. Within the airport, McHugh noticed, the two subways would be running within a few hundred feet of each other. In fact, might even intersect. This, he said, would enable the city to solve a problem which had plagued it for generations, providing a subway link between downtown Brooklyn and central and northern Queens, two areas connected only by automobile. Link up the two subways within the airport, and the connection between the two areas, so long sought but so long despaired of because of the large expense, would be accomplished at small expense. Rapid transit on the Van Wyck Expressway would solve not only the Idlewild access problem, but a host of other transportation problems. And it would be so easy to make provision for that rapid transit. Building rapid transit on the Van Wyck would provide advantages not only for New York City, but for all Long Island. The expressway ran right underneath the Jamaica terminal of the Long Island Railroad. It was that terminal that Moses was planning to hold aloft while he slid the highway beneath it. Put rapid transit on the Van Wyck, and Long Island residents would be able to get to Idlewild simply by taking the Long Island Railroad to Jamaica and transferring to the rapid transit line below. Perhaps the city could not afford at the present time even the relatively small cost of the construction of 3 miles of surface rapid transit. McHugh doubted that this was true. The cost would be no more than $9 million. It made no sense to say that a city that was planning a $280 million expressway program of its own money, not counting federal and state contributions, could not afford $9 million for an improvement that would make the expressways so much more pleasant to use. But even if it was true, he said, even if the city did not construct the rapid transit lines now, at least make provision for their future construction. The cost of providing the additional 50 feet of right-of-way would be less than $2 million, about $1,875,000, McHugh estimated. The Van Wyck Expressway, whose function was to provide reasonably fast, convenient access to Idlewild Airport, was going to cost $30 million anyway. For that amount, the road would probably never be able to fulfill its function properly. For less than $2 million more, it would. Spend the $2 million now, McHugh saw, and the right-of-way would be available whenever the city wanted to use it. Don't spend it now, and if the city should want to acquire the necessary right-of-way for rapid transit in the future, after the expressway opened, the land would be many times more expensive than it was now. Nor would the cost be limited to the price of the land needed for the right-of-way, because the land the city would have to acquire would no longer be within the expressway. It would abut 3 miles of buildings. Their owners would be entitled to substantial damages to compensate them for the noise and dirt of the trains. And land would have to be acquired not only for the tracks, but for stations. If provision was not made now for right-of-way along the Expressway Center Mall, the cost of that right-of-way would not be two, but tens of millions of dollars. So high that even if the city were to resolve to bear the enmity of thousands of protesting voters and build a rapid transit line, it might be financially unfeasible for it to do so. Reserve those 3 miles of right-of-way now, and it would be possible in future years for the city to solve the enormous problem of congestion on the Van Wyck Expressway and a host of other transportation problems quickly, simply, and cheaply. Fail to reserve it now, and those problems might never be solved. McHugh was planning to include his suggestion in the airport master plan, but he made the mistake of mentioning it first to his boss, Planning Commissioner Chief of Staff Colonel William J. Shea, from whom Moses always received close cooperation. I was called into Shea's office, and Spargo was there raising hell that I was impeding progress, that this thing had to go through and stop this crap, that I was going to cost the city millions in federal money. The whole effect was, "Why don't you shut up?" I was asked not to write any memo. Declining to accept that recommendation, McHugh wrote that rapid transit access should be provided for Idlewild and predicted what would happen if it wasn't. But his statements had been deleted when the commission approved the master plan of New York City airports. The only future on which his memo had any effect was his own. Although he was under civil service protection, there was a salary range to his position, and he had been at its upper limit. When the next city budget was adopted, he found he was at its lower limit. His salary, previously, he says, just about enough to get by on, had been reduced. He had, moreover, been fighting Moses for 8 years now, and he was well aware he wasn't getting anywhere. His report on the rapid transit reservation might as well have not been written. He resigned. As for the Mumfords and other far-seeing planners, Moses treated their predictions of disaster with the disdain he felt they deserved. Opponents who charged that he was unaware of the social implications of his transportation policies, that the ghettoization they caused and the commercial development they prevented on Long Island, for example, was inadvertent, underestimated him. He knew precisely what he was doing. He had formed his own vision of Long Island long ago, and all he was doing now was holding true to it, and that vision did not include poor people or jobs. In a 1945 speech before the Nassau Bar Association, which included most of the county's political leaders, he said, "There seems to have been a good deal of sentiment in Nassau in favor of attracting more industry and business into the county. Let me warn you against too much enthusiasm for commercializing what nature has given you. Nassau should always be largely residential and recreational. Your land lies between the bay and the ocean. These are your greatest natural assets. Figure out what sort of people you want to attract into Nassau County. By that, I mean people of what standards, what income levels, and what capacity to contribute to the source of government." He did not give the slightest indication of understanding that his transportation policies were doomed to failure. His thinking had been shaped in an era in which a highway was an unqualified boon to the public, in which roads were, like automobiles, sources of relaxation and pleasure. Changing realities could have changed his thinking, but he was utterly insulated from reality by the sycophancy of his yes-men, by his power, which, independent as it was of official or public opinion, of, in fact, any opinion but his own, made it unnecessary for him to take any opinion but his own into account, by, most of all, his personality. The personality that made it not only unnecessary but impossible for him to conceive that he might have been wrong. The personality that needed applause, thereby reinforcing the tendency to repeat the simplistic formula that had won him applause before. The personality that made it possible for him to relate to the class of people that owned automobiles and that was repelled by the class of people that did not own automobiles. The personality whose vast creative energies were fired by the vision of cleanliness, order, openness, sweep, such as the clean, open sweep of a highway, and were repelled by dirt and noise, such as the dirt and noise he associated with trains. The personality that made him not only want but need monuments, and that saw in highways, and their adjunct, suspension bridges, the most permanent structures built by man, the structures that would have a clean, clear, ineradicable mark on history. The personality that, driven now by the lust for power, made him anxious to build more revenue and power-producing bridges and parking lots and highways to encourage their use, and that made him either indifferent or antagonistic to subways and railroads which would compete with his toll facilities, not only for users, but for city construction funds. He was insulated from experience. Most of the millions who used his roads were now using them primarily not for weekend pleasure trips, but back and forth to work twice a day, 5 days a week, and driving was therefore no longer a pleasure, but a chore. But for Moses, comfortable in the richly upholstered